The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2014. Here's books editor Claire Armitstead.
Why are there so many biographical novels around at the moment? And what's with the increasingly popular subgenre of books about the wives of famous men? Two of them featured in an event on the opening weekend of this year's Edinburgh International Books Festival, and between them they covered no fewer than seven writers' wives. With me to discuss them are their authors. Naomi Wood's novel Mrs. Hemingway tells the stories of the four women who married the author of For Whom the Bell Tolls and The Old Man and the Sea. David Park's The Poet's Wives combines two real historical wives from the 18th and early 20th centuries and one fictitious one. Welcome to both of you. I'm going to start with a question that an audience member asked. And Naomi, I think it was your mum. Could you imagine writing a novel about writers' husbands? Let me give this one to you.
I think it would just be as much of a interesting and valid and legitimate endeavour as writing about the wives. I mean, the reason why I suppose this spousal narrative is popular right now is because there's a kind of revisionist approach to history in that we want to find out about the women behind these men. And the way that history is written is that usually it's about powerful men. I suppose only in the last century have we had as powerful women as we have had men. There will be increasingly, I'm sure, narratives about the husbands of these powerful women. You know, maybe we'll have Dennis Thatcher's account. I think people are very interested in nowadays finding out not just about the men that were in the kind of center stage, but the kind of liminal spaces where these women were and what they had to do to kind of support these men. So, yeah, I think we could be seeing husband narratives anytime soon.
David, you're a teacher. You were a teacher for many years as well as a writer. Spousal narratives, is this something that came up in the classroom or is this a new thing?
No, and as far as I'm concerned, you see, I was under the illusion that I was doing something terribly original. So I only realised afterwards that it was in fact part of a huge flood of similar theme books. But you write a book about what you want to write about, and that is the bottom line. And if you want to write about wives, that's good. If you want to write about husbands, that's also good.
Let's now turn to the books themselves. Naomi, I've mentioned that this is about the four Mrs. Hemingways, not although your title sort of makes it seem as if it might just be one. Tell us about them. You start off with Hadley in the early 20th century, at a point at which Ernest Hemingway has just beginning to be successful.
Yeah, Hadley Richardson was really there before Hemingway had garnered any success with his publications. They married in 1921 in Michigan and were married for the next 5 years. And she was really there at the beginning, at the source of when he was beginning to practice this interesting craft, this kind of lean economy of his prose, beginning to work up those short stories that we remember him for, taciturn and tough kind of style. And she was there in the impoverished days. You know, how much of that is true is kind of interesting. According to A Movable Feast, they were, you know, dirt poor, but I think things are a little easier. And in 1925, this woman, Pauline Pfeiffer, creeps on the scene. She's always pictured as this kind of devil in Dior figure who's out to snatch or shop for a husband, at least in Paris. And she is successful. She was also Hadley's very close friend, which makes things creepier. And they were married in 1927, Pauline Pfeiffer.
Will you read a little bit from the opening section?
Yeah. So this is from Antibes in France, 1926, and it's told from the point of view of Hadley. Everything now is done à toi. Breakfast, then swimming, lunch, then bridge, dinner, then drinks in the evening. There are always three breakfast trays, three wet bathing suits, three sets of cards left folded on the table when the game, abruptly and without explanation, ends. Hadley and Ernest are accompanied wherever they go by a third. This woman slips between them as easily as a blade. This is Fife. This is her husband's lover. Hadley and Ernest sleep together in the big white room of the villa, and Fife sleeps downstairs in a room meant for one. The house is quiet and tense until one of their friends arrives with soap and provisions, idling by the fence posts, wondering whether it might be best to leave the three undisturbed. They lounge around the house, Hadley, Ernest, and Fife, and though they know they are all miserable, no one is willing to sound the first retreat. Not wife, not husband, not mistress. They have been in the villa like this for weeks, like dancers in relentless motion, trying to exhaust each other into falling.
This is a very peculiar opening in a way, because Hadley has invited Fife to stay with them. She's almost invited the end of her own marriage. I can see exactly why you chose that moment. And they're in Antibes, and one of Hadley's, the tragedies of Hadley, although she isn't in a way a tragic figure, is that she is not part of the great glam set that he's moving into with the Fitzgeralds, all these sort of hard partying, hard drinking people, whereas Fife is.
I think it's really interesting. When Hemingway was correcting the proofs of The Sun Also Rises around about this time, he edited Hadley out of the manuscript. I always think of her as a kind of farm wife, that she's this kind of plump, rather lovely young woman, and she just doesn't fit the pageant of skinny, urbane flappers. And at this point, she invites her husband's mistress on holiday with them. And I found a little excerpt in the archives, in the JFK archives, of her saying, wouldn't it be a joke on everyone else if I invited her here? And it just made me think, oh my God. I mean, not only was it literary dynamite, because you think, what a strange thing to do, stranger than fiction. But it just intrigued me so much about why a loving wife would do that.
Now, you have these four wives. The best known of the four is Martha Gellhorn, who's wife number three. David, you have the opposite problem, which is that we don't know anything about Catherine Blake, the wife of William Blake, who is the character who occupies the first section of your novel.
Yes, and I was really grateful for that, because this is the first time I have written historical fiction, and I found it challenging. So the less factual stuff I knew, the better it was for me as a writer, because then you can use your imagination freely. But the genesis of the William Blake story comes in Peter Ackroyd's biography of Blake, a wonderful piece of work, and he's describing the marriage in 1782, which took place in Battersea in London, and he tells us that Catherine Blake signed the marriage register with an ex. And I just find that fascinating, this moment of union, of intimacy, of symbolic life together. There is this element of estrangement, of distance, of separation. And I wanted to explore that in the novel. We do know that it was a very, very successful marriage, 45 years, a marriage of love. She helped him both physically with his work, colouring the prints, but also on a deeper level as well, emotionally. Very often she just sat beside him when he was working, and because he said she calmed the turbulence of his soul. And I think, although she's a shadowy figure in history, I think she played a major, major part in Blake's life.
Will you read us a little bit of her so we can get some sort of an idea of the voice that you've given her?
Yes, as I said, they were married for 45 years, and she was a widow for four. But even after Blake had died, she believed that he came back and spoke with her. And I'm going to read a short passage just from the end of this section on the Blakes. It is 4 years since he first departed, each one the longest expanse of time dragged out as if by the tardy hands of a slowing clock. I am consumed by a great weariness. And then at last there is a slow beginning of letting go, and everything in anticipation finally given its truest colour. But for a moment, just for a single moment, I am frightened that I shall be swept into the eternal forests of some distant, starless night, until my soul lays stronger claim to its inheritance, and my eyes are clear enough to read, my heart strong enough to rejoice in Solomon's words, "Whither is thy beloved gone? O thou fairest among women, whither is thy beloved turned aside, that we may seek him with thee? My beloved is gone down into his garden, to the beds of spices to feed in the gardens, and to gather lilies. I was married with wildflowers in my hair, rose, daisy, and the sweet-scented honeysuckle. For my posy, I carried bluebells. I have one still, its faded blueness pressed between the pages of my Bible. Now this poor bed with its threadbare blankets is no longer of this world, but that bed of spices, and soon my beloved will come to gather what is finally his. And then I too shall be dressed in light, and all the infirmities and afflictions of old age shall surely fall away. Such colours then already spreading in wonder across new worlds, and I shall see the visions that were denied to my mortal eyes, my head and heart freed forever from their earthly limits, and I shall be as the woman clothed with sun, no longer the shadow of delight. And as we did when we walked in the lanes and fields of courtship, I shall teach him the names of what grows in paradise.
Now, that's fascinating because that's a really lyrical voice. It's a voice that belongs to somebody who has a very different consciousness to ours. I mean, the Blakes sat in their garden naked and thought that they were in the Garden of Eden, didn't they?
And there is an account of a visitor coming round and finding them both completely naked, I suppose in simulation of the innocence of Adam and Eve. I always wonder what he thought. Did he stay for tea or make a hurried departure? I don't really know. The most difficult part for me in writing this section of the novel was to get Catherine's voice. I mean, we have no way of knowing what her voice sounded like. We have very little of her written word or spoken word. So I think I reaped the benefit of a church, a Baptist upbringing, and I went back to a kind of almost liturgical phrasing influenced by rhythms and cadences from the Bible, and hoped eventually that might produce something that was vaguely credible.
And then you move on to 20th century Russia, where the central character is a Nadezhda, I think it's pronounced, Mandelstam, whose husband, Osip, died in a labour camp, Stalinist labour camp. And the voice changes completely.
I just find her story, especially in her book, Hope Against Hope, to be completely overwhelming. I think she was one of the strongest, bravest women in the 20th century. To be completely on your own and to hold your face up against the terror of Stalin and totalitarianism is incredible. All the parts of the story are amazing, but when Osip is arrested for the second time in 1938, he's taken to transit camp to go to labour, to the Gulag. The sad comfort that she has, and the only comfort that she can draw upon, is that she knows her husband is physically weak and his heart will not endure the deprivations that await him, and his life will not be long. And that's what happens. He dies in transit camp. But the most amazing part of the story for me is her determination, her dedication to the work, and her complete determination to preserve the work, to outlive Stalin, to have that work given back to readers. And she preserves that work in the only place that she can trust, her memory. And it's just an incredible story. And I would urge, if you have a choice between reading my book and reading her book, read her book.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
Another connection between David's book and my own is that Martha Gellhorn met Nadia Mandelstam. She went out to Moscow after having read one of the memoirs. Very, very inspired by her, but I don't think they got on extremely well. I mean, Martha Gellhorn was quite a tough and forthright character, so maybe there was a bit of a personality clash. And she also felt very, very scared by Moscow, the kind of police state, and she felt like her messages were being read, which, I mean, perhaps they were as a correspondent. So it's an interesting connection.
Did you know this?
No, I did not know that. I think quite a few people made the pilgrimage to her, and I think depending on her mood, you either got on well or you didn't. And I think, too, she on occasions was weary of being the poet's wife.
Then you move on to the third section, which is the fictional character. It actually presents the one irredeemable husband in all these books, because Ernest Hemingway, Naomi, in yours, is very redeemable for reasons that we'll talk about a little bit later. And it's Lydia who is... It brings you to your native island. She is trying to deal with the death of her faithless, narcissistic husband. Why did you decide to mix fiction and non-fiction?
I think it was essentially a structural issue for me. I wanted the book at this stage to be a triptych. I felt that there was a better balance there. And also, you know, kind of swimming with difficulty in historical fiction, I was just so glad to reach the fresh air of total, you know, imagination and not have any kind of constraint. I also thought by introducing a fictional story, I could then introduce contrasts, whereas the other stories are stories of fidelity. The final story is really a story of selfishness and infidelity. I like the idea of having a contrasting story.
Both of you have set yourself a stylistic challenge, which is to capture different periods, and it's most extreme in Poets' Wives. But Naomi, you also have to move from this very early 20th century world that Hadley inhabits of a wife who is sort of almost before our particular modern consciousness, and then you move into the very jazzy metropolitan early 20th century that we all know about, and then you move forward, so you cover many decades. How did you manage to create the different tones?
It was a huge challenge to be writing about four women in four different decades. I mean, technically, it just required a huge amount of research, and most of that was done in the British Library. It was just strange finds that you come across in the British Library. I remember having an absolutely eureka moment one day when I found a travel guide to Key West in 1937, and it described the chickens roaming the streets and the hair straightening salons. I didn't know they had hair straightening salons, and what kind of ice creams they had in the ice cream parlor. And I just thought, wahoo, this is wonderful, you know. Just finding things like that was incredible. Going to all the archives, you know, was a real treat. Going to the Hemingway collection, looking at things like his passport, looking at his wallet. For someone like me, that's an incredible moment. And to go to his houses as well, to go to Key West, go to Havana, to actually be inside one of those rooms and think, you know, because this is historical fiction, all the dialogue is made up. We don't know what they said, you know. As Hilary Mantel said, you know they're making up every time a writer says, he felt this, he thought this. It's all conjecture. And going to their houses was just incredible and helped with all the period detail as well, because you can see the kind of 1930s, you know, decoration and nothing's changed.
I said just a minute ago that Ernest Hemingway is redeemed, sort of, in your book. He's preposterous in a way, isn't he? He's serially monogamous, except for towards the end of each marriage, he's already started with somebody else. Mm. He's sort of set the seeds of his next marriage. A, why did he marry them? And B, what was this compulsion to move on to the next one?
He was a great myth maker, and he self-fashioned as this kind of faintly silly He-Man figure who the public kind of thrilled to, but it really irritated the critics. And he himself, I think, knew it must have been ridiculous and slightly boring for everyone concerned. In a moment of idleness, I tallied up how many months he'd been alone for, I suppose, unwed. It was something like 7.5 months, but between wives, it was really a, you know, big fat zero. This man, who, as I said, kind of self-fashioned as this great big, you know, He-Man figure, why couldn't he spend the night alone? And I think you can find it in the text, actually. There's a wretched loneliness there, and there's a kind of lovely sensitivity toward loss. There's a real tragedy in the heart of many Hemingway novels. And you see it in A Movable Feast as well, that he finds writing extremely difficult, even when it comes out so fluidly as it does in the 20s. And that kind of wretchedness was subtracted by the arrival of a wife, by Hadley, and also by alcohol. I mean, he used that as a kind of self-medication. So I think the impulse toward marriage was for a stability. It was for that medication to always be there. And it was a kind of ownership, I think, as well, that he wanted to be in the possession of a wife, if that doesn't sound, you know, totally awful. That's from his point of view, not mine.
David, you have a line from Catherine Blake in this first section, which is, I possess part of him, but only part. At the base of this, there's the idea of what it means to be married to an artist, isn't there?
I think this is a special case with Blake. You know, Blake as a child believed totally that he'd seen a tree full of angels, a man of dreams and visions of deep and changing passions. I just wondered, what was it like to live with such a man? And then, of course, you have the overriding situation is in that the world thought Blake at best eccentric and at worst mad, and a man who had no public recognition in his own lifetime. And the saddest words that Blake, I think, ever wrote, three words, I am hidden, you know, which is a human, a personal and a creative tragedy, that it was only after his death that the world came to recognise his genius. But there must have been incredible demands and strains on Catherine to live with that constant churning sense of passion and head full of dreams. One brief sentence we have from her is she says, I have very little of Mr. Blake's company. He is always in paradise. And I think there's a beautiful, gentle irony and humour in that as well.
And in the case of Nadezhda, she doesn't actually have Osip at all because he's been in jail for ages. And we meet her in a queue to deliver a parcel, food parcel, to him, and not knowing that he's actually dead.
Yeah. In contrast to the Blakes, they were married for 16 years and she was a widow for 42 years. And still, as a widow, deeply in love with him and the power of his work. Yeah, the section opens with queuing up to hand over a parcel. By some strange system, parcels could be sent on to relatives, mostly, not exclusively, but mostly women queuing. And the tragedy, of course, came for those people who reached the window to hand over their parcel, and it was refused because the person to whom they were sending it had died. No explanation, no expression of sympathy, just go away. And the woman walking back down the queue with that parcel became an incredible symbol of suffering and tragedy. You know, and one of the most difficult things I think she had to do in her life was to hide her anger. I think there were moments in her life during the Stalin period when she could have really screamed at the world. But to preserve the work and to stay alive, she had to hide that anger, and I think that was an incredible challenge for her.
She also had to remember. She committed to memory all of his work, and she carried it. She was like a sort of human memory stick in today's terms.
That's right, that's right. And one of the interesting things in the original Hope Against Hope story is that, I think it's Hope Against Hope, that Osip was occasionally involved at some level with other women from time to time. And I think there were some poems that he had written and he wanted to someone else, and he wanted to destroy them, but she prevented him. And I think there's no greater expression of admiration for the art.
Naomi, the one person who we know an awful lot about of your four wives is Martha Gellhorn. And it must have created a totally different challenge writing about her to writing about the other three.
One of the challenges of writing about this book was trying not to be repetitive, because Hemingway makes similar mistakes throughout his life. So how was I going to make Pauline Pfeiffer's loss of Hemingway versus Hadley Hemingway's loss in any way different? And then with Martha Gellhorn, it was like a breath of fresh air, because she was the only one who left him. And it was a peculiar case because their affair lasted for as long as their marriage. And I'm still curious about why they married. I don't think she wanted to. I think she kind of got bullied into it and realized that she had to commit, you know, if she was going to keep on having this relationship. A journalist at the time described them as a pairing of flint and steel. And I think Gellhorn just saw through his kind of hyper-masculine facade and just couldn't be bothered with it.
They've got on much better in war zones than they did in peace.
Yeah. There's a great quote from one of her letters where it says, you know, we were good in war, and when there was no war, we made our own. The battlefield neither of us could survive was domestic life. And what's really interesting from her Cuban letters at the time is how much this kind of restive sense that she really wants to get back to the front line. She's desperate. She picks up this taste for war. And she says, you know, work is a unique opium, you know, and being at the front line somehow makes you feel extremely alive. Hemingway, by this point, he was in his 40s. He didn't want to go and cover another war zone. You know, he'd been on the verge of death, shot up in the First World War, and then, you know, shot up several times in the Spanish Civil War, and thought, here we are in Cuba, in this paradise. Why would we leave to cold old Europe? And she's going, let's go back. So there's a huge gap between what they wanted, I think. And it was no wonder that they didn't last very long.
Mrs. Hemingway is published by Picador, and The Poet's Wives is published by Bloomsbury.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.